This is the second message on providence, God, our governor and preserver. And what we saw last time is that God governs all things and God sustains or preserves all things. And there are no exceptions, as we saw in our Westminster Confession study this morning in the chapel. He has ordained whatsoever comes to pass. The lot is cast into the lap and every decision comes from the Lord. The sparrow doesn't fall from a tree apart from the will of our Father in heaven. He's numbered even the hairs upon our head. Thomas Boston, who's among a number of people that I will name as we go through this series, because I want us to become familiar with some of the classic theologians, Bible teachers of Christian history. Thomas Boston, late 17th century, early 18th century Scot, said, "In everything the finger of God is to be seen." Ephesians 1:11, "He's working all things after the counsel of his will." Romans 8:28, "God is causing all things to work together for good for those who love God and are called according to his purpose." Consequently, we are always dealing with God, and he is always dealing with me for my good. When I am wronged, the vital question is not, why did they do that to me? The vital question, the bigger question, is what is God doing in the midst of these circumstances? Providence means that everything in life is significant. And everything in life is purposeful. So there's no fortune, there's no misfortune, there's no good or bad luck, there's no chance, there's no fate. God is sovereign over all of our circumstances. He is sovereign over every interpersonal encounter that takes place. He is sovereign over every opportunity and circumstance of life. They are all important and they are all to be taken seriously. Another way of saying all this is to say that God is the God of the ordinary. I think it's fairly common amongst Christians in our day to be looking for God in the miraculous. And it's the miracle that's the sign that God is at work. I believe that this view of providence teaches us to look for God in the ordinary. He doesn't suddenly become active when a supernatural event takes place of some sort. He is always active, always working, always to be seen in the circumstances of life, ordering those circumstances for the good of his people. We call ourselves an ordinary means church. This is, as it were, a branch of the same thing. Ordinary means meaning by what? That God isn't to be seen. He isn't to be looked for only in the supernatural. Now, if God intervenes, if he suspends natural law, if he suspends the natural order of cause and effect, that's a wonderful thing. And periodically in the history of the world, God has done that. But what is his normal way of working? His ordinary way of working is through what we call the ordinary means. And so when is God at work? Well, he's at work whenever his word is being read, preached, sung, prayed, and his sacraments are being administered. That is the place where, those are the places where, the means where he has promised to work. And so when people are born again, they're born again by the living and abiding word. When they grow in grace, when they're sanctified, they grow by the pure milk of the word. They come to faith by hearing the word of Christ, Romans 10:17. God works through the ordinary means. And it's this high view of providence that teaches us to see God at work in the ordinary circumstances of life. I'll say what else that this means for us. It means that we also may recognize what we might call amazing providences. This may just be a matter of definitions, but I think most of what people call miracles today, what they're really talking about are extraordinary providences or amazing providences. Amazing coincidences, divinely ordered, divine appointments, as it were. Let me give you an example. Probably the most significant single month in shaping my adult ministry took place when I was in Scotland in the spring of 1978. I spent a month with Peter White in Edinburgh and was introduced to William Still and the Cree Fellowship. And that had a decisive life-directing impact on how I would view ministry and how I would conduct ministry. So after that month, I was just overflowing with thoughts and ideas and convictions and things to discuss and talk about and work through. And the train to Bristol pulled into Newcastle, which, you know, is northern England, pulled into Newcastle. And it was one of any number of trains that would have been going south. There must have been a dozen train cars for the passengers to load onto. But onto my train car came my best friend in England, Chris Bennett, with whom I discussed everything. And I watched him tramping along the platform. He went into my car, came in and sat down next to me for the next 6 to 8 hours, which flew by as though time were standing still. We discussed and argued and debated and worked through everything I had learned. That train ride was a divine appointment. It was an amazing providence. It was an extraordinary coincidence, but a divinely ordered appointment where it was clear to see the hand of God in arranging circumstances for the edification of me and for the edification of my dear friend, Chris Bennett, who, you know, has gone on and is a minister in the London area right now. What I'd like us to do then is to apply our understanding of providence to a number of different areas. We begin with the matter of calling. What does God want me to do with my life? Now, before I answer that, I want to digress for just a moment because there is a problem with interpreting providence. It can be problematic. For example, if I encounter a barrier, is that a thing that God would have me overcome, or is it a sign that I should change course, change direction? If I submit a manuscript to a publisher and the publisher rejects it, is that a sign that I should give up the project? Or am I meant to persevere and continue knocking at the doors of the publishers until I find one who will take on my project? If I'm applying for a job and I get turned down, is that a sign that I should look for a job somewhere else, or should I persist? If I get turned down for a date, does that mean I should persist and risk being thought of as a creeper, or should I continue to pursue? Providence is not self-interpreting except in a general overarching sense. And yet we are meant to learn by what's taking place in our circumstances. For example, in Amos 4, 6 through 12, there God visits famine on Israel. And then he says, and yet you did not return to me. So after famine, the plague. And he says, and yet you did not return to me. Then war, and yet you did not return to me. In other words, these adversities were meant to humble Israel and bring Israel to repentance. But they didn't interpret providence properly. They didn't learn by his many judgments to turn from their sin and return repentantly to God. And so the many judgments led to the ultimate judgment. And the Assyrians came and destroyed the northern kingdom and carried it off into captivity. They failed to learn. Similarly, in Romans 2, 4, the Apostle Paul there says, do you not know that the kindness of God leads you to repentance? The kindness of God. What do you mean the kindness of God? All those blessed things that are taking place in your life, all those benefits that you receive, all those blessings, all those good things, the kindness of God. You did not properly interpret the kindness of God in your life. All those blessings that you have been receiving, they did not lead to your repentance. They did not result in you turning back to God. You did not properly interpret the circumstances of life. You didn't properly interpret providence. So I'm saying interpreting providence is problematic. Nevertheless, in general terms, it's important that we do interpret providence and learn from our blessings and from our adversities and not fail to learn, thereby making it necessary for yet more adversity to come. Making necessary further judgments. Or, as in Psalm 73, suffer the fate of the rich who get who have no pain in life, but are like an animal being fattened for the slaughter, because the blessing, the wealth, does not result in their submission to the kindness and goodness of God. Learn from circumstances. Learn from God's providential dealings with us. So let's look then with first at this area of calling. Well, one other thing wanted to say one more thing about interpreting the providence. Learn as well that it's not always obvious. For example, when there is a tragedy, is that really a tragedy, or did I dodge a bullet? For example, the man who was caught in traffic, and so he missed his flight, and he is furious because he's missed his flight. The flight crashes and everyone on board is killed. At one point, that seemed to be a very disagreeable turn of events for him. But in the end, it looked very different than as it did at that moment. All right, moving along to vocation. I have this friend. He loves dentistry. He's always loved dentistry. Since he was a little child, he loved dentistry. As he matured, he continued to love dentistry more and more. He became a mature Christian. And still, there was no alteration in his love and desire to one day be a dentist. So you ask yourself, why does he love dentistry? Well, that's very difficult to answer. He just always has. And yet there were certain stimuli along the way. The fact that he was born into a 21st century family that emphasized education, that was a factor. So he learned to study. He was a student. He learned to love math and science, some of the background to going into dentistry. He had that teacher in the fourth grade who really encouraged him in this area. There was the college counselor in high school who also encouraged him in the direction that he was heading. So when you look back at the whole of his life, there was this almost innate desire that led him in a certain direction. There were some providential factors like his family, like his teachers, like his schools, like the counselor. The question that one should ask then is, who was sovereign over all of those creational and providential factors that went into making that young man the person that he was? Wasn't God sovereign over all of those factors? And so when I ask the question, what am I going to do with my life? These are the kinds of things that we look at. We say, what are my gifts? What are my abilities? What are my desires? What are the opportunities that I have had? A person might say, well, you know what I really want to do in life is I want to build sandcastles. Well, that at that point, and you might be very, very good at it. You're a very skilled sandcastle builder. Your sandcastles are beautiful creations, admired by all, swept away in a matter of hours by the sea, but they're beautiful. Well, you might want at that point to differentiate between avocations and vocations. That may be a wonderful avocation to have, but will one be able to support oneself and support a family? Probably not. So that is the matter of providential opportunities. You weigh those things out. What has gone into making me what I am, creating, giving, endowing with the desires, the gifts, the abilities, and the opportunities that I have? The gifts and calling of God go hand in hand. Consequently, all of those factors come to bear in answering the question, what ought I to do with my life? The answer is, what has God equipped me to do with my life? Because of our understanding of creation and of providence, we understand that God is sovereign over all of those factors. Let me give you an example. The Apostle Paul. The Apostle Paul is the apostle to the Gentiles. He's converted on the Damascus Road in Acts chapter 9. But when he writes to the Galatians, he says that he was set apart for the task of bringing the gospel to the Gentiles from his mother's womb, from birth. He wasn't just set apart at the time of his conversion. Paul can look back and he realizes that there were providential factors that began at the time of his birth, and God superintended the development of the Apostle Paul to the point of his conversion, post-conversion, all along, all then coming to focus in this calling to take the gospel to the Gentiles. For example, the Apostle Paul had Roman citizenship. That's going to prove to be important. Not everybody had Roman citizenship. It was a valuable thing to have. It was costly to purchase a Roman citizenship. He was classically educated. He is able, in Acts 17, to quote pagan poets in his sermon to the Athenians. Classically educated. He also received what would be the equivalent of a Harvard education in Judaism, having sat at the feet of Gamaliel, the leading rabbi of that day. Trained by Judaism, trained by Roman classicism, Roman citizenship, all of that then uniquely prepared the Apostle Paul for his mission. Who was sovereign over all those factors? Was it not God who providentially first created and endowed him with certain gifts, but then superintended their development, bringing him to that place where he was able to serve God in that specific way? Doctrine of providence has everything to do with how we pursue our vocations. What should I do with my life? What have I been gifted to do? What are the aptitudes that I have? What are the abilities that I have? What are the opportunities that I have? And do they come to bear? Do they come to a focal point in a given area of life? It's a terrible thing to waste gifts. Why? Because God gives them. It's a terrible thing to waste opportunities. Why? Because God creates them. Learn to see God in the ordinary. Second, let's look at prosperity. This view of providence teaches us to credit and thank God for all that is good and right in our life. James 1:17, every good and perfect gift is from above, from the Father of lights, in whom there is neither variation nor shifting of shadows. Every good and perfect gift is from God. My good health, my financial prosperity, my happy family gathering, an enjoyable meal. Everything that we enjoy is a gift from God. You take that wealthy, healthy, famous person and just ever so slightly alter their circumstances, and they are poor, in pain, and unknown. If we prosper, we prosper by the hand of God. Proverbs 10:27 is the blessing of the Lord that makes rich. Ecclesiastes 7:14, the preacher says, in the day of prosperity, be joyful, and in the day of adversity, consider, God has made the one as well as the other. The Apostle Paul asks the proud Greek Corinthians, 1 Corinthians 4:7, what do you have that you did not receive? It's a rhetorical question. The answer is obvious. There isn't anything that you have that you did not receive. Receive from where? Receive from God. Every good gift, everything that we have comes to us by the hand of God. Therefore, we should be thanking God for everything that is good and right in our life. From the smallest thing, from the refreshing breeze that blew across our faces when we walked out the front doors this morning. To the inheritance of a vast fortune. It all comes to us by the hand of God. Third, adversity. So calling, prosperity, adversity. I think only with this view of providence will we learn to trust God in our adversity. Let me quote from Thomas Watson, one of the great English Puritans. He asks this, does any affliction befall you? Now, an affliction can be a health matter. Affliction can be a relational matter. It could take a variety of forms. He's asking, does any affliction befall you? Remember, God sees it is that which is fit for you, or it would not come. You have an affliction. God sees that it is fit for you. That adversity is fit for you, or it would not come. Any lesser view of adversity, it ends up in the end removing God from the picture, claiming that he's not responsible, that he is not at fault, and consequently he is not there, and so he cannot be trusted. No, Watson is saying, no, that adversity, it comes to us by the hand of God for our good. What are we to think when there's a great tragedy, when a child mourns, when there's a crippling accident, when there's a fatal disease that one encounters? Here's what the Puritan Flavel says, John Flavel, in his book, The Mystery of Providence, one of the classics of Puritanism. Providence has ordered that condition for you which is really best for your eternal good. You may be able to look around and say, well, I don't see how this is good for my health. I don't see how this is good for my family in the immediate future. But Flavel is saying, look, if Providence has ordered that condition for you, that is that which is really best for your eternal good. There is design in that affliction. There is intention in that affliction. This includes emotional and spiritual suffering as well as physical afflictions. There may be times when we feel that we've been abandoned by God. There may be times when we can find no comfort in his word or in his people. The ancients spoke of the dark night of the soul. It's a common phenomena among the people of God, where we're left trusting just the naked promise of God for our good, when the evidence of the truth of that promise cannot be seen in our surroundings and in our circumstances. And the psalmist in the 88th Psalm, verse 6, you have put me in the depths of the pit, in the regions dark and deep. Verse 14, O Lord, why do you cast my soul away? Why do you hide your face from me? See, there's he cannot find God. He cannot find any comfort from God, any reassurance from God, any joy and peace from God. He reckons himself abandoned, as did Jesus on the cross and David before him, when David wrote in Psalm 22, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? And yet David and Jesus address God as my God, still trusting and believing in the place of dire affliction and abandonment. Here's Calvin. Whatever our circumstances, we are to know that the Lord has willed it, therefore it must be borne. Not only because one may not contend against it, no use kicking against the goads, but because he wills nothing but what is just and expedient. We can cite Flavel again, John Flavel. God would rather hear me groan here than howl hereafter. His love is judicious, not fond. He consults my good rather than my ease. William Cooper, looks like Cowper, wrote a number of our great hymns, but he was a man much given to depression and greatly struggled with the dark night of the soul himself. And in one of his hymns, the last stanza concludes with these words, behind a frowning providence, he hides a smiling face. The circumstances that we providentially are encountering, he says, it's a frown. It's bad. It's tough. It's hard. It's painful. It's hurtful. God seems to be frowning upon us. But those frowning providences are like the clouds hiding the sun. Behind them, there is a smiling face. Behind the clouds is the favor and the goodwill and the kindness and the goodness of God. And then lastly, all things. This view of providence gives us the outlook that we need on our calling in life. That was the first point. Second point was that it gives us an outlook on prosperity in life. The third point, it gives us the outlook that we need in the adversity that we face in life. In prosperity, it leads us to thank God for all that is good and right. In adversity, it teaches us to trust God in our pain and suffering. As for all things, then, this view of providence teaches us to see the good in all and rejoice. Watson again. Christians believe that all God's providences shall conspire for your good at last. All God's providence shall conspire for your good at last. How do we know that? Well, we know it because of Romans 8:28. All things are working together for the good of those who love God and are called according to His purpose. That's how it is possible for the Apostle Paul to commend to us, rejoicing always and in everything giving thanks. Philippians 4:4. Rejoice always. How can you rejoice always? Well, you can rejoice always if you know that whatever circumstances I may find myself in, they have been ordered by God for my good. All things are working together for good for those who love God and are called according to His purpose. Otherwise, we could not rejoice in the Lord always. Otherwise, it would be impossible. What we are confident of is that from evil, God is bringing good. That's the Augustinian formula. God allows the evil for the greater good, for His people as they encounter evil. And whatever form that it takes, the hardship, the pain, the suffering, it's for our greater good. All things for God, all things for good. So we have the example, Genesis 50:20, Joseph. Joseph is sold into slavery by his brothers. You know, consider the emotional devastation that would have brought to a young man. His brothers abandon him. They talk of killing him. Instead, they throw him in a pit to die. These Amalekite traders come along. He's sold into slavery. He's hauled off into Egypt. He's separated from his family for decades. You know the story. Finally, they're reunited. Jacob dies. His brothers are frightened that he will avenge their wrongdoing on him. What does Joseph said? What you meant for evil, God meant for good. Accident? Bad luck? Chance? Misfortune? No. God meant it. You meant evil. Not absolving you of your guilt. You were wrong to do what you did. You meant evil. God meant good. God designed it for good. Don't remove God from the picture. God was in it. They were doing their worst. From that, God was preserving the people from whom would come the Messiah. God meant it for good. Acts 8:1-4. After the execution of Stephen, it says there arose on that day a great persecution against the church in Jerusalem, and they were scattered throughout the regions of Judea and Samaria. Churches scattered by persecution. Persecution, that's a bad thing. That's a harmful thing for the church. People were suffering. People were martyred like Stephen. It was a dark day in the life of the early church. What was the result? Verse 4, now those who were scattered went about preaching the word. Scatter the church. You know, like Tertullian said, the blood of the martyrs is the seed of the church. The blood of the martyrs is scattered on the ground, and what springs up but a multitude of believers as a result of the witness of the martyr? Persecute the church, all you did was scatter the preaching of the gospel. They meant it for evil, God meant it for good. Take another example. Philippians 1, 12 and 13. There the Apostle Paul talks about his imprisonment. The Apostle Paul is arrested. He's put in prison by the Roman government. Tragedy, right? Terrible. Here's the leading preacher of the day. Here is the greatest evangelist in the history of the church. The greatest missionary in the history of the church. The man who established congregations all throughout the Mediterranean world. And who authored so many of the vital epistles, whose summary of the gospel in Romans is unsurpassed in ancient literature. And now he's in prison. And in prison, he will ultimately be executed. Tragedy, right? Terrible. Awful thing that's happened. Destructive. Yes, and from one perspective, absolutely it is. It is a disaster, really, for the early church. And yet, here's what the Apostle Paul says about it. He says, I want you to know, brothers, that what has happened to me has really served to advance the gospel so that it has become known throughout the whole imperial guard and to all the rest that my imprisonment is for Christ. He talks about the witness in Caesar's household because of the imprisonment of the Apostle Paul and his witness to the guard, and because others were emboldened by his example. And so you imprison an Apostle Paul and a dozen others go out and fill in the gap, who step up, as we say today. What they meant for evil, God meant for good. Now, let me ask of you personally, is this not the cure for our anger? For what others have done to us that is wrong, for circumstances that have conspired against us? Is it not a cure for our anger to know that God is behind the occasions of our dismay for our good? Again, will we not learn patience, knowing that God is working all things for our good, even that which frustrates and annoys us? To use our young people's favorite term, he is so annoying, they say. She is so annoying. That's become the be-all and end-all of what's wrong with somebody. They're so annoying. Well, you know what, that annoying person? It's not accidental that that annoying person is in your life. So will we not learn patience, knowing that that which frustrates and annoys us is present in our life by the hand of God? And so can we not give thanks and rejoice in all things, knowing that Romans 8:28 is both a fact and a promise that God will work all things for our good? Let me close with Thomas Boston again. Speaking of God's works of providence, he says, In these his works, no flaw is to be found. No mistake. Nothing for us too much. Nothing too little. Nothing too soon done. Nothing too late done. Nothing misplaced. Nothing in or over. Nay, nothing done that is not best done, nothing that man or angel could make better. All things for good, all things for God. Let us then bow our heads and worship Him.